we going to wake up too late? This is an intergenerational issue. We, you and I, and our generations and above us have used the antibiotics. What are we leaving for our children and grandchildren? We really need to get this right.
Hello, my name is Andrew Pollard. I'm director of the Oxford Vaccine Group at the University of Oxford. Welcome to our podcast series, The Oxford Colloquy, Trust in Science, bringing you the stories, facts, and people behind the science. On this podcast, I'm going to be speaking with Dame Sally Davis, the former government chief medical officer, who has devoted her career to hematology initially, and then through supporting policy development in government, and today championing the cause of preventing antimicrobial resistance to protect our health. Professor Dame Sally Davis, Fellow of the Royal Society, Master of Trinity College, Cambridge, and UK Special Envoy on AMR since 2019, and former Government Chief Medical Officer. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. It's good to be here, Andrew.
Sally, so you started off your career studying medicine in Manchester. Why did you decide to do medicine?
I wasn't very good at school. I failed the 11 plus, and it took me until the sixth form to be kind of top of the class, but only in biology. And what do you do with biology? If you like people, you end up in medicine. So I didn't have a big push into it. I'm the first medic of the family, but I did develop a vocation as I went through it later on.
So then in your training, you, having qualified in 1972, decided to move into hematology, which is the study of blood diseases. Why did you decide to do hematology? What was it that got you interested in that? Was it so you could stay in the laboratory and look down a microscope, or was it the patients?
Isn't it interesting the role that chance and life plays? So I wanted to be a paediatrician, but if you do paediatrics, it's really difficult on the work-life balance, almost impossible. So then I was given the opportunity to try hematology, and I tried it, and I liked that combination of looking down the microscope and seeing what you were treating, but having the patients.
Well, I certainly I can echo your sentiments about how difficult it is in paediatrics in juggling the work-life balance as a paediatrician. And then in hematology, you focused on sickle cell disease. What is that disease, and why was that important to you?
So sickle cell disease is an inherited genetic disorder where you inherit from each of your parents, who are healthy carriers in general, the gene which makes your red blood cells, when they give up oxygen, become not nice and squidgy so they can go through your little blood vessels, the capillaries, but stiff and sickle, banana-shaped, and then they block those blood vessels. And the consequence is a bit like a heart attack, where if you get a short-term blockage, ow, it hurts because no oxygen's getting to the heart. If it lasts a while, you get scarring and tissue damage, which can affect the kidney or bones or something. But it can be overwhelming and kill you. So that's the disease. It affects predominantly people from sub-Saharan Africa, but also Indian, Arab, and many others, because if you're a carrier, it gives you, as you know, Andrew, as well or better than me, some protection in that against a nasty malaria in that very crucial first year or two of life. And so that's why it's persisted.
Yeah, so it's a disorder which is bad for you in some senses, but also the carrying the gene can be very helpful in protecting you against malaria, which is why it persists in populations where there's a lot of malaria around. And so you became very interested in that because of the disease, I guess. How have you seen that change over your career and its management?
Yes. I mean, in my day, we had just symptomatic treatment, painkillers, fluids, oxygen, and then blood transfusion and exchange blood transfusion. That's now been made much more automated. There's even novel gene therapies beginning and looking quite successful. The sad thing about that is we'll be able to treat, maybe cure, some people. But it'll be so expensive that the masses of people across the world won't be able to access it. And we still don't really have good agents that you can take by mouth and will cure it.
So you worked as a consultant haematologist for about 20 years. And then at some point, you decided to go into the civil service. What was it that made you walk away from your clinical practice, which was very successful, and go into the civil service?
So it was a very staged transition. I was asked in the early 90s to join the research funding committee for the region. The story was that they wanted someone from a district general, and I worked at Central Middlesex, who understood laboratories, and I did, and wouldn't it be another tick if it was a woman? So I was asked. I was building a research program around patients and patient-related research at Central Middlesex, but the joke always was that I said nothing for the first year on this committee as I watched how it worked and I learned. The second year I said a small amount, made me questions. The third year I contributed, and then they asked me to chair it. So I was chairing it, and then we had the changes in the NHS to introduce NHS research and development, and that had regional directors, and our then regional director left. And because I was a woman and I was at a district general, no one thought of me to become the regional director until they couldn't find, using headhunters, someone they wanted. And then the director of public health rang me up and said, come and see the regional director tomorrow because we think you could do it. So I was appointed. Half-time, I continued my sickle. After that, I was then appointed to the whole London region. Then each time there was a reorganisation, I got promoted to the bigger job. And eventually, I was made the Director General. All of that was on secondment to the civil service. And I continued clinics until 2006, as a matter of fact. But then I went full-time on secondment, and it was only when I became chief medical officer that they said, because of security issues, you have to join the civil service. So I retired from the NHS and became a civil servant.
And so then as chief medical officer, full initially from 2010, then full-time from 2011, you were then in that role really until Sir Chris Whitty took over, who was very familiar to people from the pandemic. But actually, the role has existed for a long time, and there were some major changes during your time there. What are the things in your time advising government in the Department of Health that came up that you think were really important for transforming health in this country?
So there were structural changes, and then there are what do you as an individual bring? And every person in these big independent advisory roles shapes it round their own understanding. The issues that came up, well, we started with the 2009-10 pandemic, flu pandemic, and so I had to learn about pandemics. That was probably an easy way in, wasn't it? But we had Ebola, we had Novichok, and those were important. But I also reinterpreted how I did my statutory annual reports. So predecessors had written monographs, and I split it into a data-rich report and then not a monograph. I was the reporter in the sense that I chose the subject, the experts, and wrote what that meant for policy, but I got experts writing their chapters. And that was a very different approach, and I'm rather pleased that Chris Whitty liked it so much he's continuing it. And so we did very important reports on the health of women, on genomics, on, well, a whole myriad of things. And they really did impact. The other thing I did was that for all it was my report and independent, I made sure that I discussed the recommendations with the people who needed to do it. And so by the time I landed the report, they knew what was coming and they could usually come out and say, yeah, we're going to do that, or this is a great report and we agree. And so I'd already brought most people into where we were going and that direction of travel. And I think that was very useful.
And so with this sort of area of trying to legislate to improve public health, there's always lots of accusations of a nanny state and your role in that. How do you think that should be dealt with? Because clearly for public health, these are critical issues, and you can only deal with them really by having some central control of them. But there is a pushback against that.
Well, I don't think it's central control, it's central regulation. And so the examples I use are seat belts. A lot of people thought seat belts were wrong, but we regulated as a nation. They came in, and now people recognize that they were in the interests of saving lives and, even more importantly, damaged people. And it's the norm. The smoking ban in public places, exactly the same. A lot of fighting against it, but now no one would think about it. And so these regulations are in the interests of everyone. They're hard fought, but generally once they go through and settle in after a year or two, everyone says, oh, yes, we should have done this long ago. The problem is we have a rising, because it's a libertarian group within our public, often coincides with the kind of populist approach where these problems belong with the individual, they should just be stronger and we shouldn't regulate. That doesn't understand all the neuroscience around addiction and norms and behaviours and the need for behavioural economics. And it doesn't actually respect the difficulty for families being in the flood of unhealthy products. It doesn't notice the imbalance between the billions spent on marketing but for unhealthy lifestyle issues, whether it's food, alcohol, slumping on the sofa, which I do on occasions too. I'm not saying you should never do it, versus trying to do it yourself. So we have to do it. I suppose what I object to is this concept that it's a nanny state. All the more funny coming accusations coming from people who were brought up by nannies, and we can think of many people who were. But of course, as the first woman CMO, when applied to me, it also felt sexist.
Absolutely. Now, one of the other things that you are particularly known for, Sally, is having the drive and the passion to establish the National Institute for Health Research when you were the chief scientist, so just predating your role as the chief medical officer. And how did that come about? And I mean, I can see how with your trajectory through hematology and research on sickle cell disease, that this translational area was really underfunded. So that the money, I should say, from this government research funder is all around translating discoveries into the NHS. So how did that become a major part of what you did in the 2000s?
Well, it goes back to my drivers, which come from childhood. My father was a theologian. My interest is in trying to make this a better, fairer, healthier world. It's not about anything else. And when people ask me, did you enjoy power? I point out I've never had power. Indeed, in this role here, it's all about influence. How do you get things to happen that better our country, our people? And what I saw, which if you were in a big teaching hospital, you might not have seen, was how unfair the research system was when I was sitting on those committees and I was a regional director. Those who had money could use it for research, the rest didn't have it. And even then, there was a lot of money that was said to belong with the research that seemed to be going into the walls of the hospitals. And so it seemed to me we had an unfair system. We also had been in the 70s and 80s at the top of clinical research across the world, and we were no longer valued for our role because it was all too individual when what we needed were platforms and collaboration and much broader. And it didn't seem that there was any push to get answers to the problems we needed answering to treat patients, to look after people and everything. So based on values, I went into the department and said, we've got an unfair system that doesn't solve the problems we've got, and we're spending a lot of money and we're not shining as a nation. Seems to me it's all wrong, and here's my proposal.
And that's really been driving since the mid-2000s, and it is now a huge program which has, I think, really transformed clinical research in the UK over that time. And I think a great legacy to have from your time in the department.
Yeah, I feel very proud of what people have done with it. And when I handed it over after a decade in 2016 to Chris Whitty, who'd become the Director General for Research, I handed him a budget of 1.25 billion cash a year to spend, when we'd started with nothing in my hands. You know, so I'd built it and we'd created a system. And I keep meeting people who are NIHR researchers or who are proud of a trial they've done. And it's so lovely to see how people have really lent in and made it work and made us able to be proud as a nation again.
And of course, we still have funding going into basic research as well, which is we absolutely need in order to then take through into the...
Essential. And I was very careful to make sure everyone knew that the basic research mattered, and this had to be built on top and never take money away from basic research. And I achieved that with my deputy colleague, Russell Hamilton, without whom this would not have happened.
And of course, the basic research is where all the discoveries happen that then get translated into patients. So, yeah, very important indeed. So a lot of your focus actually towards the end of your tenure as Chief Medical Officer and subsequently has been on antimicrobial resistance, which seems a long way from sickle cell disease to me. It's much more in my world than yours. Why was it that became the spark for you? And you've won many accolades for your work in this area, quite rightly. But what is it that's made you a champion around antimicrobial resistance?
Actually, I started in 2013, my first advocacy CMO report was on infection. And it came out of that, because what I realized when the writers of each chapter came back together again was that superbugs were going up and up, antimicrobial resistance. There was an empty pipeline of new drugs and interventions, including vaccines in your interests area, because of a market failure, because we pay too little. And when I said to the experts, so what are you doing about it? They all said, well, we keep telling people. And what I saw was that, you know, the technical experts were not getting cut through. They didn't know how to highlight it to get action. And so by the end of this day, I ended up saying, okay, I will give voice to this problem. And that was how it started. And as I got more and more interested, I realized, just like NIHR was a systemic solution to a very complex set of problems, that AMR is extraordinarily complex. I talk about it as a jigsaw, and I'm very good at thinking about how to deal with those and very good at interacting both as a boundary spanner between the scientists, the technical experts, the patients even, but the policy and the politicians. And so I just got drawn in, and here I am now, known around the world for my advocacy and pushing on the subject.
And with antimicrobial resistance, so these are the bacteria which are becoming very hard to treat with antibiotics because they are resistant to all of the antibiotics that we routinely use. And so we have to switch to more and more expensive antibiotics. And indeed, for some infections, we have nothing.
Well, 1.3 million people die every year directly, and it's the third most important underlying cause of death after heart disease and stroke. So it's a big problem.
It's a big global threat, absolutely. And so you started off by talking about the lack of a pipeline of new antibiotics, which, of course, was the thing we were really worried about 10 years ago. But actually, I feel as if the discussion's moved on now and that we're much more concerned about what are we doing wrong that's driving antimicrobial resistance. So whose fault is it, Sally? Is it we doctors? Is it farmers giving antibiotics to their animals? Where is the problem?
You can't simplify it like that. I wish we could. It is a behavioural problem that in poor countries, in fish farming, and after all, fish is a protein, is the biggest rising protein production and eating across the world of any protein. People, farmers, just tip antibiotics into the water and then they flow into the water systems. In many countries, antibiotics are used in pig and chicken and beef farming to protect against getting infections and for a bit of growth promotion. In humans, they are misused as well. So there's a behavioural issue about can you get access to them? If you can, are they the right ones? And are you using them in the right way at the right time? Prevent infection has to come top, which is, as you know, cleanliness, washing your hands and vaccines. But then if you've got an infection, giving the right antibiotic, which takes you into diagnostics, and you can only give the right antibiotic if you know what the pattern is there, you have a diagnostic ideally, and you can get access. So across the world, access is a massive problem. That said, we do know that there are plenty of people in the rich world who demand antibiotics because it validates that they're sick and they believe antibiotics cure them even when it's viral, which of course they don't. And in poor countries, if it's taking them 4 hours to get to the local village which sells them, they're going to buy them and take them because they're not going to go home and then come back again. So you can see how difficult it is. So we all contribute.
Yes, and I think the other thing which you're alluding to is, particularly from my experience working in South Asia, is that there are places where there are very few doctors and the population absolutely rely on pharmacies for treating their children. And so there's no ability to make a diagnosis. You've got a sick child, you don't treat them with antibiotics, some of them will die. And so they're actually life-saving. I mean, they are life-saving drugs. And it's just the difficulty of knowing who you should give them to, which none of us are very good at knowing. Are you then optimistic about the future or this pandemic of resistance? Is it, as you say, the third most important cause of death? Is it really a major threat for the future of populations?
Well, yes, it is, because it's, while there's an emergency about resistance in bacteria, you and I know that a lot of patients with cancer get fungal infections, and increasingly they're dying of resistant fungal infections. Increasingly, people with TB, when they're diagnosed, have been infected with resistant TB. So it is a problem that's growing. The data that we will see published early autumn on the burden of disease, a sneak preview, shows that actually, while the total burden in the world is staying about the same, the poor countries, it's getting worse. In conflict areas, it is dreadful, where the rich countries, because we can wash hands, we have generally good sanitation, though I worry about British rivers and AMR and the impact of that, and we can do the diagnostics and get the right antibiotics. The rich countries, it's being contained and often falling a bit. But the fact that the level across the world is staying similar is scary, because one in five children under the age of five in sub-Saharan Africa are dying of resistant bacteria. That shouldn't be acceptable. 66% of the bacterial meningitis and sepsis in newborn babies in India and Africa dying of resistant organisms. I mean, that's awful.
But did you feel that we're doing enough to tackle this? Are you optimistic? You're sounding pretty pessimistic to me, and I'm not sure what we need to do.
Oh, well, I'm a glass half full person. When I started in this, everyone said, what are you talking about? You know, yes, of course it exists, but it's not that important. We've managed to get everyone now to recognise it matters. We had a high-level meeting at the UN General Assembly in 2016. Our next high-level meeting is the end of September this year, which means that heads of state and senior ministers will be there discussing AMR. We will be publishing just before it New economic analysis to show that there's an economic risk with it, new burden of disease, new work on the animal sector because food security is at risk. So we've progressed so everyone now knows this matters. And if the rich countries are beginning to do things, now's the time to help the poor countries take action. So I'm optimistic that we will steadily make progress. There is a problem that we have yet to really incentivize the pharmaceutical system to make new antibiotics. And you and I know it takes 20 years from saying, oh, here's a good target, to getting the drug licensed and in use. So are we going to wake up too late? This is an intergenerational issue. We, you and I, and our generations and above us have used the antibiotics. What are we leaving for our children and grandchildren? We really need to get this right. But we can.
So definitely more work to do in this space. And at least it's on the agenda. And I think very good news that it's going back to the UN again later this year. We're speaking in July, or almost July, of 2024. Definitely throughout all of this, and particularly with things like antibiotics, as you said, there's the question about trust in doctors and trust in science. And if a patient comes to you and you say, no, you can't have any antibiotics, that can actually undermine trust in that doctor where you're expecting to be supported in your view that you need them. Well, are we doing enough in this space to improve the public's trust in us?
Well, no, we always need to work at that. And I think the biggest example takes us into your area, which is about vaccines. You and I, as technical people, know the value of vaccines. We know the risk of a side effects is terrifically low, and that it helps us individually and as a population. And yet, somehow, we haven't managed to persuade everyone in our population. It's not bad, but we need better. So it comes back to communication. And trust is based, I think, on transparency and communication. And when I refused antibiotics to patients, they accepted it, but it took me two or three times longer for that consultation than it did if I just wrote a prescription. So not only do we have to be able to communicate, we have to have that time. And at the moment with the NHS, if I look at it from a British perspective, under such stress, they don't have a lot of time. And so that makes it very difficult. And I think if other things are being difficult, you've waited ages to see a clinician or whatever, then they damage trust, even though we know that all the data shows that the public trust doctors more than almost anyone else in the country. But we have to demonstrate we're worthy of that trust.
So do you think that doctors and scientists should have more of a role in the media?
Well, I think we all have roles. I did get fed up in COVID with what I called rent-a-quote, where colleagues of ours would get up and an epidemiologist would talk about vaccine response, and someone who was expert on vaccines would talk about behaviour. I do think we all have a role in communication, but stick to what you know and think and learn how to communicate, which is not by complexity, it's by telling stories and it's about unwrapping it. I mean, Chris's style using next slide, please, turned out to work very well. But you have to find your own style. But it is about transparency. And please, experts, stick to your areas. You always talked about vaccines. You were totally credible.
I think it's important, as you say, for people to stick in their tramlines, because that's the area that they know, and they can be both credible and also competent in what they say.
Yes.
Sally, you talked about appointments earlier into your the various committees that you're on, and then you were the first woman to be chief medical officer, and I think also the first woman to be master of Trinity College, Cambridge. Yes. There's a very long history going back many centuries of men in that role. Is that something which has been important to you in your career, and being such an important role model in those leadership positions. And do you think over those decades since you qualified in the 70s that life has changed?
I hope life has changed. My daughters tell me it has, that I should stop battling. Mum, you know, you made it, and we don't have to battle like that. But I don't think it's changed at the top. I still think that women and minorities as well have to prove that they're better than the men for many of the top jobs. And I felt that when I became the Director General for Research and CMO. Actually, for this post, I don't feel that. I was just the right person in the right place at the right time. So I think we're making progress, but we haven't got where we need to be. We are not gender neutral yet. But I am proud that I've been able to forge that path by hard work. But it is hard work.
Dame Sally Davis, thank you very much for speaking with us on this podcast, for your work with patients as a haematologist in public health, particularly in your roles in government and championing AMR, and also for your leadership roles as a woman in science and in government and at Trinity College. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Lovely to see you, Andrew.
That was the Oxford Colloquy Trust in Science, bringing you the stories, people and facts behind the science. So you might be wondering, what is a colloquy? A colloquy is a discourse or conversation, and I hope you'll agree that that's what we've been having.